From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM, emerging artists for you tonight. All their websites linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. Go take a look. Next hour, End Times Prophecies with Chuck Missler. Get ready for that. Here's what's happening. Japan's government has warned that it may now take months to stop radiation leaking from a nuclear plant crippled by a huge earthquake and tsunami 3 weeks ago, as more bodies were recovered in the devastated areas of northeast Japan. An aide to the embattled prime minister there said the government's priority now was to stop radiation leaks, which were scaring the public, I guess so, and hindering work on cooling overheated nuclear fuel rods. The Southwest Airlines jet forced to make an emergency landing at an Arizona military base Friday after a hole was torn in the roof of the passenger cabin that suffered fatigue cracking, according to the National Transportation Safety Board. How would you like to be on that plane when all that happened? The announcement came after news that the Federal Record show cracks were found and repaired a year ago in the frame of this Boeing 737-300. They're finding a couple other cracks in some of these planes. A three-year-old boy freed himself from a safety harness, stood up, and fell to his death from a roller coaster he was riding with his family at a Chicago suburban amusement park. Sad story. Jason Dansbury of Chicago, the suburb of Dalton, who was sitting near the front of the moving Python Pit roller coaster with his twin brother at the Go Bananas amusement park about 15 miles northwest of Chicago when he freed himself and fell while his family was watching. Consistent lifelong exercise preserves heart muscles in the elderly to levels that match or even exceed that of healthy young people. A surprising finding that underscores the value of regular exercise training, according to a new study. The first study to evaluate the effects of varying levels of lifelong exercise on heart mass was presented at the annual scientific meeting of the American College of Cardiology in New Orleans. Christian Wild, who is a noted author, of course, and his website, myheartbook.com. Christian, this doesn't come as any surprise to you, does it?
No, it doesn't. We always knew and always will know that exercise, particularly at any age, it doesn't matter if you haven't done it most of your life, but you start late. There are still tremendous benefits. Increases good HDL, lowers your risk of high blood pressure, diabetes, and, of course, heart disease. But as we age, keeping that heart pumping at its capacity is also important in getting blood and oxygen into the cerebrovascular arteries and veins and vessels in the brain to keep us mentally in good shape as well. I remember the fellow a couple of years ago, I was talking to him about exercise, and he said, I only have so many heartbeats in this heart, and I ain't going to waste it on exercise. You know, George, that muscle the size of your fist?
Yep, that's it.
Pumps 100,000 times a day. I don't know who keeps track of all that, but 100,000 beats a day. And in a lifetime, supposedly, our heart pumps enough blood to fill 3.5 of those giant oil tankers out in the Gulf. So it's a very important muscle, just like your bicep, your tricep. If you go a short period of time and you haven't exercised, you will start to see atrophy. You will say, 6 weeks ago, my muscles were looking great, and all of a sudden, when I quit, they shrunk.
That's right.
Now, I have a concern about the older people, George, because exercise can be intimidating. Many people are dealing with foot pain, with arthritis, with joint pain, lower back pain, and they hear the word that you should do 150 minutes of exercise a week. I want to say that it's cumulative. If you get up in the morning and you don't feel like it, and you're hurting, and you're able to get maybe 10 minutes, you walk to the market and you walk back. Later in the afternoon, maybe you can go to the post office, just as an example. So now you've gotten 22 minutes. It doesn't matter. As long as you add up at the end of the week and you've had 150 minutes, make it easy on yourself, because you can get intimidated and then end up not doing it at all.
Well, Christian, there is no doubt that exercise helps. And as you've just said, it keeps us around for a long, long time. Thanks, Christian Wild. In Detroit, Charlie Sheen was heckled, booed, and eventually abandoned by the crowd at his inaugural stage show, which many of the audience members chanted, "Refund," and headed for the exits even before the show abruptly ended. Winning, not on opening night for Charlie. The first stop on Sheen's My Violent Torpedo of Truth defeat is not an option. 20-city variety show started Saturday night with thunderous applause, but ended 70 minutes later. In between, Sheen tried to appease his audience with rants, a rapper, and a question-and-answer session, ultimately concluding the first show was an experiment. It was on the Chicago Today. I've got to tell you, the show was a disaster. It was a bomb. Even got into an argument with somebody in the crowd. And Charlie apparently said, "I've got your money already, dude." And it just did not go well. A UFO was spotted in Chicago Saturday night. At least that's what some local residents believe they saw. Several residents say they spotted what looked like UFOs gliding through the sky over Chicago's south side. Those who claimed to have witnessed the flying objects were called seeing several orange-colored lights floating together, traveling in a straight line at first, and then maneuvering into different patterns. What could it be? The image is eerily familiar, a bearded young man with flowing curly hair. After lying for nearly 2,000 years, hidden in a cave in the Holy Land, the final detail is difficult to determine. But in a certain light, it is not difficult to interpret the marks around the figure's brow as a crown of thorns. The extraordinary picture of one of the recently discovered hoard of up to 70 lead codices, booklets found in a cave in the hills overlooking the Sea of Galilee, is one reason biblical historians are clamoring to get their hands on the ancient artifacts. If genuine, this could be the first ever portrait of Jesus Christ, possibly even created in the lifetime of those who knew him. Up next, Dr. Ken Hansen joins us. We'll talk about this incredible discovery in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Fascinating hour here in store with Dr. Ken Hansen. He is an extremely dynamic author, lecturer, founder of Treasures in Time, an organization devoted to disseminating knowledge of the biblical and classical world. He has dug on archaeological sites in the Middle East, lived in the volatile region of northern Galilee as well, taught Hebrew on an Israeli agricultural settlement, and he's with us to talk about this new discovery. Here's Dr. Ken Hansen back on Coast to Coast. Ken, how are you?
Good. Good to be with you, George. And, of course, warm shalom from the Judaic Studies program at the University of Central Florida, Orlando.
Thank you so much. What a discovery. Tell me, how did it come about?
What a discovery, indeed. Literally out of the blue, at least for most of us, just a matter of a few days ago, and it's just been burning up the Internet. And, of course, it's been reported on international media, where we've got a series of codices of lead books, apparently, that bear some amazing inscriptions. We have letters, we have images that purport to depict the very earliest evidence we have of the Judeo-Christian movement. Maybe, at least it's claimed, to be almost as old as Jesus himself, as the first few years after the crucifixion, perhaps. Maybe their evidence of the family of Jesus, known as the Ebionites, which was mentioned just last night on the show, as a matter of fact. This is just fascinating for so many of us, and I can tell you that I, of all people, very much want this to be genuine. I want this to be true. I wrote a book that was released just over a year ago called Bloodkin of Jesus, James and the Lost Jewish Church, where I basically say that the key is not looking at Paul, not looking west, not looking at the Roman church as it ultimately developed, but go east, young man, go east, go into Jordan if you want to find the actual family of Jesus who perpetuated his traditions in a very, very early period. And here we have documents that apparently have come out of Jordan. It's just remarkable.
And they were found, what, about 100 miles from where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found?
Yeah. And having written several books about the Dead Sea Scrolls, that is also particularly fascinating to me. The book of Revelation talks about sealed books In several places, and the Dead Sea Scrolls. In fact, I'm just working on my own fresh translation of some of the fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and this I just recently produced. It's a fragmentary Dead Sea Scroll found in one of those caves. They're just like little jigsaw puzzle pieces, and here's how I translate it into English, that this is the interpretation regarding the eras or the ends that God has made, all that is and is to come. He determined their works and their eras and their dominions were engraved on everlasting tablets. Everlasting tablets. And sure enough, we have some sealed tablets that came right out of this region. I say it's all about location, location, location.
And these codices, Ken, they differ from the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were primarily text. These are more images, aren't they?
They're more images with some coded letters on them. And the letters are in Hebrew, but not the Hebrew that we're accustomed to in prayer books today and in Hebrew Bibles, the Hebrew used in Israel today. This is ancient, really ancient, Paleo-Hebrew, with sort of a Hasmonean flavor. The Hasmonean dynasty, which was in existence in the first few centuries before the Common Era, the first couple centuries before the Common Era. And I'm one of the minority of scholars who actually thinks that it was Hebrew, not Aramaic, that was the spoken language in the days of Jesus of Nazareth. The Dead Sea Scrolls are over 90% Hebrew. So for those who say, oh, Aramaic was the spoken language, what do you do about the Dead Sea Scrolls? What do you do about this preponderance of Hebrew? These are Hebrew letters. That alone is compelling.
Tell me the significance of this discovery, Ken.
Well, if they're genuine, then it's extremely significant because, as I write in my book, what we're lacking really is some kind of archaeological evidence of how the early followers of Jesus, the family of Jesus, his brothers, the Gospels themselves tell us that he had brothers, including James, the famous James who wrote our epistle. Jude is another one. His family kept alive his tradition in the East. This is a lost church that we know virtually nothing about. They stayed in Jerusalem right up until a tragic revolt broke out against the Roman Empire in the year 66 of the Common Era that left the city of Jerusalem literally a smoking ruin in 4 years, 70 of the Common Era, 70 AD. Jerusalem was destroyed. The temple was destroyed. What about the early church, as it were, the family of Jesus? What became of them? The Book of Acts tells us that they stayed in the city of Jerusalem. They set up their headquarters in Jerusalem. They would have been wiped out along with the rest of the city had they not decided literally to flee, to get out of Jerusalem in the nick of time. And I'm convinced that the Book of Revelation in particular is also a code that tells the family of Jesus, hey, it's time to leave. You better go east. Go east, young man. Get out of here. Go over the Jordan River, Transjordan, east. And we even have ancient records that tell us that they settled in a city in Transjordan called Pella. But where's the archaeological evidence for this? We don't have anything but just traditions that they fled to the east. The Book of Revelation is all over this in its coded language, talking about a dragon that spews water out of its mouth, trying to swallow them up. And that seems to be representative of the Jordan River itself. And yet the earth opened up and swallowed that water that the dragon had spewed out, as if to say that they were able to ford the Jordan River. They were able to cross it safely before the Romans destroyed Jerusalem. That's key. They saved themselves and they saved their movement. There would arguably be no Christianity. It would have been wiped out had these followers of Jesus not made this escape into Jordan. So I've been looking for evidence of this and any textual evidence of their existence. These Ebionites, as they're often called, or the Nazarenes. There are several names from. Another one is the Despoteni in Greek, which means the heirs, the physical heirs of Jesus. They had their own dynasty, apparently descended from Jesus. So imagine how I, of all people, would be just thrilled if we could find archaeological evidence, even textual evidence, that these descendants, James and his descendants, succeeded and went on into Transjordan.
Ken, I have no doubt that a man existed a couple thousand years ago by the name of Jesus. And it's obvious that with the Dead Sea Scrolls and things that we're beginning to find, these codices, that there was a person like that. How do we know? How do we really know that this individual possessed these incredible abilities that we hear so much about?
A lot of it is faith, but we do have records, and that's the important thing. If you take the gospel accounts seriously, then you say, hey, we have written records. And one of the things that I've devoted decades doing, even though I'm a Judaic studies scholar, is studying the Christian Gospels. I believe that especially Matthew, Mark, and Luke root down to an early Hebrew text, and by the way, a lost text, a missing text that we don't have anymore, but was translated into Greek. So if we take our Greek Gospels and try to retranslate them back into Hebrew, we have a remarkable biography, as it were, of Jesus of Nazareth, and an early one as well. Jewish scholars, Israeli scholars, by the way, are fascinated with this idea of trying to find the historical Jesus. Whatever your faith perspective is about Jesus, we believe he's a historical person. Now, having said all that, these documents that have just been found are causing a huge amount of controversy, and you can expect that they will continue to cause controversy. And their authenticity, though I would love to believe them, let me tell you, is being called into question. And I have to say that as an objective scholar of the period, there are some serious problems that, as much as I like this to be true, we have to recognize.
If they're not true, if they're not authentic, then who would have created them, and when might they have been made?
Well, unfortunately, there is in the Middle East a whole industry of creating forgeries. And some items that I also would really like to believe were authentic, such as an ossuary. This is a burial box of none other than James. I just mentioned him,
right,
the purported brother of Jesus. Is seriously called into question, and the consensus is that it's a fake.
Is it for financial gain, Ken? Are they trying to discredit Christianity? What's going on?
People get great financial gain and notoriety out of circulating forgeries. And this one, again, just in the last few days, initially it's just a huge wave of excitement, and we want to believe it. Faith and belief is a powerful thing. And so, naturally, people want to believe that something as spectacular as this is true. But then you have to sit down and you have to examine it carefully, and you've got to weigh both sides. I always tell my students, I'm a professor, so I say, look, the academic world is like a big courtroom. And when you go into court, you're a lawyer, and you have to anticipate what the other side is going to say. You're going to have detractors, and you need to anticipate their arguments and acknowledge their arguments. And if you don't at least acknowledge their arguments, you're going to lose in court, and you're going to lose big. And the court is the court of public opinion as well as the academic world. That's where we have our problems.
Apparently, the owner of all of these is a Bedouin trucker who lives in the Arab village of Umm Galamb.
That's right.
He refuses to sell the booklets. He sent a few samples to England and Switzerland for testing, but they were discovered about 5 years ago, and we're just finding out about this now. Why does it take so long?
Well, we would expect it to take even longer, I suppose, when you think of how long a lot of these documents and artifacts have circulated around. The Dead Sea Scrolls languished for decades, literally, before they got out into the public. A lot of them did, at least. So that's not surprising. Sometimes a person will just sit on artifacts like this and see how much the price will go up. The problem is we don't know where they came from. Now, this is a term called provenance. Provenance means the place of origin, the location. If an archaeologist had come across this, for example, then you know exactly what cave it was found in. You're able to go and photograph every square inch of it. You know a lot about the artifact just by its provenance. But when things like this are found by Bedouin, everything's a big question mark. The Dead Sea Scrolls, many were found by Bedouin, in fact, also a problem of provenance. And yes, the scrolls were also called hoaxes and fraudulent when they were first discovered. So that's what we're up against. But where did these things come from? Which cave exactly? And then another big problem, I have to tell you, has to do with being able to date these. Now, ultimately, the Dead Sea Scrolls were resolved when carbon-14 was able to show conclusively that this material is ancient. It's 2,000 years old, some of it even a little older. So when you have good carbon dating, then my favorite saying, by the way, is faith must bow before the facts. That's what we're after, is always factual information.
Well, I've got to tell you, Ken, these archaeological discoveries for me, absolutely fascinating, as I'm sure they are for you. Let's come back and talk a little bit more about this with Dr. Ken Hansen. We'll also take your phone calls if you got a question with him. Well, next hour, we're going to talk end times prophecies with Chuck Missler, so make sure you're part of that program. And when we come back, we'll talk with Dr. Ken Hansen about this incredible discovery in Jordan and take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Ken, before we go to calls, so what was your reaction when you heard about this discovery? Skeptical? Excited? What was it?
Excited, ecstatic, until the last few hours, I have to be honest. That's how
what happened?
This whole thing is just evolving with lightning speed. And that's what happens sometimes, especially in the age of the blogosphere. Again, no one has wanted to believe this is authentic more than myself. This would seem to confirm some of the things I wrote in my most recent book. You can find it on my website, by the way. But what I discovered essentially is a smoking gun that we have here. Because I have examined the photographs that have been released. They look very intriguing. Mm-hmm. There's art on them, including what appears to be walls, say, of the city of Jerusalem. There's an interesting image, perhaps, of a cross, a menorah. There's palm trees that are in fruit, which is apparently an ancient Davidic symbol. David was like the palm tree who was fruiting. And then an interesting star that brings to mind the prophecy of Balaam in the Hebrew Bible. A star shall come forth from Jesse, from Jacob. So very interesting stuff until I discovered, again, doing lots of research all this day, that there are identical images of the palm tree and the star on other plates that were identified in September of 2010, definitely as fraudulent. And they are known to be fraudulent, these other plates, because they contain writing in Greek that is reversed, like mirror reversed. It's very bad Greek, and moreover, an inscription in Greek had been lifted from a tombstone in Madaba in Jordan. I've been there several times, so I know this area. A tombstone in Madaba in Jordan, and then reversed like a mirror, and then copied onto this copper plate. Bearing these same images, and then you check the images, and I put this on my website as well. If you click on my website and then go to blog, and I've got the images from this find in September 2010, clearly a forgery, and then you compare that with the images on several of these lead plates. And I've gone back through these images, and I'm finding at least five of these booklets that bear identical images of the fruiting palm tree and the star, exactly as we find on the fraudulent plates. So I've been racking my brain, and I don't see how this is anything but fraudulent. Probably a forgery, definitely a forgery. So
when will we find out officially, Ken? Or will we?
That's the question. And in archaeology, these things can go on for years. I mentioned the James Ossuary. That trial has been ongoing for years, and still there are appeals to it. The head of the Biblical Archaeology Review, the editor-in-chief, came to our university on our invitation to speak about this, and he was convinced it was absolutely authentic. I was convinced with him, and sure enough, this trial has gone on and on. I don't know if this will result in a trial, maybe a trial in public opinion, but I suspect that we're going to see a lot of controversy. Hold your horses. This is going to get brutal in the months to come.
Okay, let's go to John and... Lima, Ohio. There you are, John. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, John.
Hi. A few quick questions. I think it would be kind of interesting to go back and look around the time that the Dead Sea Scrolls were found to see if there was any particular UFO activity, because, you know, we just had some kind of activity around Jerusalem.
Yes, we did. That's true.
Yeah. Outside of that, has there ever been any bones or human fragments found that indicated that they were affected by the lead that they worked with health-wise?
We're talking about these lead codices now, which are not to be confused with the Dead Sea Scrolls. No, there's nothing in the caves. There are a few other artifacts supposedly in the caves. But again, the caves and everything about them is being questioned because the archaeologists didn't find them in these caves. The Bedouin did, just like they found the scrolls in these caves. And then they looted them, and you have empty caves, and there's very little, if anything, left in them. As for the UFO question, of course, we scholars consider that some serious speculation. But I do find it interesting, and I'm working on some translations now, as I mentioned earlier, of the scrolls and fragments of the scrolls, fresh translations, my own in English, that do cite various ancient texts such as Enoch and Jubilees in their earliest versions now in ancient Hebrew in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And some of them do sound, at least to me, hauntingly like astrophysics and lots of mention of angelic beings. I like to call them non-terrestrial beings as opposed to extraterrestrial. But if you wanted to find UFO activity, all you have to do is look at the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves. It's a matter of interpretation at that point. It's really haunting.
Has the Bedouin tried to profit from these codices?
It's speculation even in terms of the reporting, because so much is being said so quickly. Yeah, there have been rumors of that. The Israelis said that this Bedouin gentleman has been trying to hawk this type of material for years. Of course, then there are denials on the other side. That's what we can expect for some time. The Jordanians, in the meantime, are trying to repatriate this back to Jordan, where they were found. And I can understand that, although in my experience, the Israeli Antiquities Authority is really superb. And personally, I'd like to see them handle all of this. I recognize the legal claims, but the Israeli Antiquities Authority is I'm afraid, also very speculative about this.
Lee is in Maryland on the wildcard line. Welcome to Coast, Lee. Go ahead.
Yeah, the word Hebrew, that means passing over or passing through, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Avar in okay, the language now, itself.
Yeah. Okay. Now, everybody on the ark, did it pass over anything or did it pass through anything? And everybody on that ark must have been Hebrew. Now, Ham and Shem and Japhetha and Noah himself, they were of the different races, weren't they?
The progenitors of the various human races. That's the idea, yes.
So that means when they came off the ark, they might not have been a Hebrew when they got on the ark, but they were Hebrew when they got off the ark.
You can
right?
think of them as passing over the waters, although probably the direct etymology would relate to Abraham passing over the Tigris and Euphrates, going on into a land that he knew not, that turned out to be the land of Canaan. But there is imagery of passing over, avar, as I mentioned, to cross over, that's throughout the Hebrew Bible. We're going into a new land that we knew not of.
There seems to be, a percent, Ken, of people who are non-believers of any of this. In religion, in just about any facet of God's existence.
And skepticism's healthy, I say.
Yet there's a tremendous majority that believe in the existence of God, a higher power as well. What is it, in your opinion, that makes mankind strive to find the answers about this, about faith? What are they looking for?
I ponder this all the time, and the best thing I can come up with in my own mind is a single word, meaning, and try to define meaning. Try to come up with a definition of the word meaning,
yeah.
And it defies us, and yet we know instinctively that we need it. And we, of all species on our planet that we know of in the universe, we alone, humanity, Homo sapiens, desperately need to have meaning. We can't survive without meaning. And as long as we need meaning, then we need to probe something beyond ourselves. And even as scholars, that will lead us in the direction of the divine.
Next up, first-time caller, there's actually a town called Rough and Ready. It's in California, and there's Pam. Go ahead, Pam. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm on a cell phone, so I might not get real good reception. But I wanted to find out if you've heard anything about the Hebrew Gospel of Matthew that was found in the 1980s by George Howard.
The Hebrew Bible of Matthew, Ken?
The Hebrew Gospel of Matthew. There's actually several of these in the Jerusalem Museum. They were found after World War II, and a scholar called George Howard did some research on them in the 80s and wrote a book on them in 1995. It's been reprinted several times. And a recent scholar named Nehemiah Gordon, who is actually a Karaite Jew, mm-hmm. did some research on it for a friend of his who was a Christian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there are early texts of Matthew called the Gospel of Matthew. And it's an interesting, you have to really go into a lot of scholarship and research on how all this came about. Did Matthew really write Matthew and so on? Now, we're told that Matthew did write a gospel in the Hebrew tongue. So you might be onto something there. This might be very significant, though personally, my sense is it's probably a later text as well. And what I'm looking for would be an undertext in Hebrew. Don't think we'll ever find it, but it would be nice, that probably dated to the first few years after the crucifixion. That's why another reason why I was so excited about this find of lead books. You know, maybe we've discovered one of these things that might have been written by the actual Matthew and then was translated into Greek, then the original Hebrew lost. But then there have been several attempts to reconstruct that earlier Hebrew version. So we have various versions of Matthew that have come down, but still, I'm not convinced that that's the ancient one we're looking for.
West of the Rockies, Paul, Corning, California. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, George and Ken.
Hi.
Really, really great show tonight.
Thank you.
As always. I'm going to go ahead and make myself really, really transparent. I used to be a born-again Christian. I've lost my faith. Not completely. I think the find that you're talking about is incredible. I have some health issues, Crohn's disease, working into the small intestine, and also they're telling me that, you know, I've got anywhere from, I don't know, 3 weeks to 6 months to live with a liver that's also failing. And so I think the need we were talking about earlier is also about death, facing the grave bravely.
Yes.
I really think that, that's a big issue. I think that's where a lot of our religious longings come from as well. Not just that. I mean, synchronicities and so forth, my life is filled with it. But anyway, make myself transparent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm somebody who's trying to find my faith again. And I have so many questions. I know the scriptures on a fundamentalist basis. I guess there's so many things. Normally when I call in, you know, I just kind of I get off. I say what I have to say and I get off. But I think I need to really sit here for a moment and discuss these things. I need my faith. People need their faith. We're in a situation where, you know, the world is just brimming over with hostilities and problems. And what do we do about it all? You know, I'm sitting here going, oh, my gosh, this is terrible. But it's filled with hope still. And what you're talking about is incredible. But let me get to the point. The point for me is before I go, I need to have something to hold on to, where do we go? Where do we go with this? I mean, is Jesus, the historical Jesus, was he? I mean, there's scriptures that, you know, a lot of fundamentalist churches don't talk about, like the strong man takes it by violence. So it's almost like Jesus was a zealot. You know, he was a revolutionary, ready to, you know, kick butt and.
Well, he was a revolutionary. I mean, he went against the grain. There's no doubt. Hey, Paul, I'm going to have Ken respond, but I want you, after he's done, to stay on hold. I want your phone number because I want to talk with you on the air later about what you're going through, because
thank you. But you know what? I do have a problem. Somebody just changed my number, so I don't exactly know what the hell my number is.
All right, you're going to have to call us back then. So Ken,
can I do that?
Hold on for 1 second here, Paul. We'll get Gina to talk with you, but I want Ken to respond to this. What do you say to someone like Paul, Ken?
Well, I love the scripture you quoted. Absolutely love it. I've worked on that for years, in fact, and it's a perfect example of how we take a Greek text, put it in this hypothetical Hebrew undertext that I honestly believe someone named Matthew actually wrote within a few years of Jesus. So it's kind of a radical opinion, but it's very well thought out, scholarly, very well worked on. If you take that same passage, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, the violence take it by force, I could quote it in Hebrew. I don't think it'll mean much to you, but I'll translate it. Malchut ha'elohim poretzet v'ha'polzim ochazim ba. Is what we get in Hebrew. The kingdom of God or of heaven is breaking forth, and those who are breaking forth with it are participating in it. Not violence, but breaking forth. And it relates to material we have in the Jewish Talmud. Again, I'm a Judaic scholar, and one thing we fail to do is to read this stuff against Judaism. Again, it's another reason I was hoping these lead books could be absolutely authentic and lead us into more of this. Jesus, I don't see as a revolutionary in the sense of violent revolutionary. The kind of apocalypticism he was talking about was being ready, and I love that idea. Let's be ready for the end every day, and then let's participate in this kingdom of heaven, and that means in the here and now. And that is also what Judaism focuses on. It's not about the hereafter so much as it is about the here and now. If you take care of the here and now, the hereafter will take care of itself. Let's break forth in every way, participate in the kingdom of heaven. That's his teaching in any case, I'm convinced.
Okay, and Paul, we're going to keep you on hold. We're going to have you talk with Gina, all right? Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Gordon's with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Gordon. Go ahead.
Hi, George. I'm a big student of Prince Maddock, and I've just recently read some new information that has to do with the Colburn alphabet and the Cymric language as it relates to all of the inscriptions. There are over 50 of which have been found throughout the Ohio Valley, and much of that translation was done by a couple of gentlemen from England, Blackett and Wilson. And I was just real curious for the longest time in deciphering a lot of the inscriptions that are relative to this area that date to the 6th century when Prince Maddock and his folks were here from Wales. Were often mistaken as Hebrew, and they were Colburn and Cymric. So I'm just real curious to see if by chance when these inscriptions begin to be translated, if in fact there is a tie-in there. And as an adjunct to that, George, I just finished reading. Tell me what you see. And I know that Major Ed Dames could be called in here, and he could do the historical remote view to tie in and help authenticate and substantiate exactly what these are, because in the book it tells us that he knows where the Ark of the Covenant is.
Well, that's very interesting. Prince Maddock, by the way, after he apparently went to Mexico in that region, people think he might have been, of course, the white Aztec Quetzalcoatl. Nobody really knows for sure, Ken.
Yeah, I'd love all that to be true, especially the Ark of the Covenant bit. That would really be nice. Would really be nice. Of course, anything Hebraic, such as these old inscriptions, and I have encountered some speculation about these ancient inscriptions here in the Americas that might in fact be Hebrew. It's nice though when we have something more than code to go on, or a few letters here and there. That's the difficult part of these lead books as well. And if we're wondering, you know, why these might be written in this way as forgeries, well, it's a lot easier to produce just a few letters as forgery than it is to produce a flowing text like a Dead Sea Scroll.
Well, I got to tell you, Ken, it's just a dramatic story. Let's see if it ever gets authenticated. Thank you so much.